Fly Fishing Internet Radio, your source for learning more about fly fishing in cold water, warm water, and salt water. Hello, I'm Roger Maves, your host for tonight's show. On this broadcast, we'll be featuring Matt Lucas, and he'll be answering your questions on drifting the Green River. This show will be 90 minutes in length, and we're broadcasting live over the Internet. If you'd like to ask Matt a question, just go to our homepage at askaboutflyfishing.com and use the Q&A text box to send us your question. We'll receive your question immediately, and we'll try to answer as many of them as possible on the show tonight. And while you're there, make sure you sign up to receive our announcements so you don't miss out on any of our future broadcasts. Just fill out the form on the right side of our homepage, and we'll let you know when the next live show will be. This broadcast is being recorded and will be available for playback on our website about 48 hours after the show ends. You can also find it on any of the podcast sites like Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Stitcher, or wherever you listen to your podcasts. So if you have to leave early, you can return to our website or any of the podcast platforms at your convenience and listen to the recording at any time. If you're out and about on Facebook and Instagram or X, be sure to post something about our shows. When you do it, use hashtag AskAboutFlyFishing and hashtag FlyFishing. I would truly appreciate it. And if you have time during the show, please, please help us out in that regard. The content of this broadcast is copyrighted and is the property of the Knowledge Group, Inc., doing business as AskAboutFlyFishing. When we return, we'll be talking with Matt Lucas about drifting the Green River. Watermaster is dedicated to providing their customers with the highest quality inflatables on the market, as well as unbeatable customer service and product support. They are best known for their signature products, the Watermaster Grizzly, Kodiak, and Bruin rafts. These rafts are lightweight, compact, durable, versatile, and safe. The Watermaster rafts are everything your personal watercraft should be. They have been used by anglers and hunters all over the world. Visit Watermaster today and take a look at the ultimate personal flotation craft. Go to BigSkyInflatables.com. Again, that's BigSkyInflatables.com. Before we introduce Matt, we'd like to let you know about the great prizes we have to give away tonight. For our drawings tonight, we'll be giving away a one-year membership to Fly Fishers International and a one-year membership to Trout Unlimited. Now, if you haven't registered yet for the drawing, you can do so now. Just go to our homepage, AskAboutFlyFishing.com, and look for the link under tonight's section that says Register for our free drawing. Click on that link and fill out the form, and we'll announce the winners at the end of the show. We'll also be giving away, and listen carefully, we'll also be giving away a one-day float trip for two on the Green River, courtesy of Western Rivers Fly Fishery Guides, which is Matt Lucas's business. So this is special. We don't often get a prize like this to give away, so I'm sure you're all going to listen very carefully tonight. So here's how you win. You must be the first person to answer the question that ask at the end of the show, and the question will be about something that Matt and I talk about during the show. You can guarantee that tonight it's probably going to be a two-part question just to make it more difficult. But at the end of the show, we'll ask you to submit your answer along with your name and location using the text box on our homepage. So listen closely, take notes, pay attention, type fast, and maybe you'll be the proud winner of a one-day float trip for two on the Green River, courtesy of Western Rivers Fly Fisher Guide. Our guest tonight is Matt Lucas. Matt caught his first golden brown trout on the Green River when he was about 10 years old. Since then, he has made thousands of trips down that river, as well as many others here in the West. He started his guiding career as a fly fishing backpacking guide in Estes Park, Colorado. There he ventured all through the Rocky Mountain National Park and the rivers of that area, like the Roaring Fork, the Yampa, and the Dean, and also the Elk and Smith, just to name a few. He eventually made it back to the Green River, where he now guides fly fishers from around the world. He understands how the river fishes, wherever it flows, and is astounding. Matt, welcome to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio.
Hey, thanks, Roger, for having me. I'm excited to be here.
Yeah, well, good. We're excited to have you. It's been, many years since we talked to anybody about the Green. I think probably 10 or 15 years. So we need an update. and you're the man. So we should have fun tonight. We've got lots of good questions, and it's not snowing here, and the weather's good, and the wind's not blowing, so we're all set. We shouldn't have any interruptions. Okay, so let's just for the people that may not have been to the Green River, can you give us kind of a geography lesson, let people know where the Green River is?
Yeah, well, that is a big question. Well, the Green River where we fish or where we guide at is below Flaming Gorge Dam, and that's located in Daggett County. It's one of the smallest counties in Utah, and it's right on the northeast corner of the state. We're about 5 minutes from the Wyoming border, and as a crow flies, about 20 miles from Colorado. So,
yeah, really tucked in there.
to give you an idea where we're at. But, yeah, the Green River starts all the way up in the Wind Rivers just north of Pinedale and runs all the way down to where it meets the Colorado just south of Moab.
Right, right. Now, can you give us a little history? I mean, this is a tailwater fishery that you fish and guide on. What's the history behind the Flaming Gorge Dam? Can you fill us in on that a bit?
Yeah, I mean, its primary purpose is water storage. It's part of the upper Colorado River Basin and the compact that was created. And that's basically to store water for years that there aren't, you know, as heavy as snowfalls, as big as snowpacks, which we've definitely seen that and reaped the benefit of having that, some of these reservoirs set in place, which also comes with some consequences. For sure. But yeah, that's kind of its purpose and why the dam was put in. It was started in 1960 and finished 4 years later in 1964.
With all the talks of dams coming down, you know, out on the Snake River and stuff, is that at all, is there any conversation about that? Or maybe you don't face the, you know, obviously, you don't face the salmon runs going up or the steelhead runs going up the river like they do out further west. But no talk of that, bringing that dam down? Or?
Yeah, I mean, there's not much talk of this one. You know, we don't have steelhead or salmon returning, but it has negatively impacted other fish, the razorback chubs, the pike minnow, bony tails, just to name a few. And actually, they do a simulated runoff event to flood the estuaries near Jensen every year to help out with the reproductive habits of those fish. So it has negatively impacted certain species. They don't get as much attention just because they're not considered a game fish or a sports fish.
Right.
You know,
yeah,
but
yeah,
still very important and, you know, something we always have to consider when we're putting a type of infrastructure like a dam in place anywhere, you know.
Yeah.
But I would, based on our continual growth across the Intermountain West and the Southwest, I think this dam just becomes almost more and more critical.
I think if
population grow.
Yeah, I think if I remember right, there is no other dam between it and the Glen Canyon Dam at Lake Powell, right?
It's way up the drainage or within the, you know, Colorado River Basin. And yeah, it's definitely, it's the largest tributary where it meets the Colorado.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
I mean, it makes up a huge part of the water and that water resource for almost 40 million people in 7 states.
Yeah. 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 It's interesting.
It makes up almost half of that.
Yeah, I floated, well, I fished where you are up there in the tailwaters, and I've also floated Gates of Lodor and down through Whirlpool Canyon and all that, for, you know, running the rivers, rafting, and then floated it down in southern Utah, and yeah, it's quite the river. I mean, and then it comes down there and meets, the Yampa meets the Green, right? And then the Green and the Yampa go on down to meet the Colorado and becomes the Colorado River, so it's super important tributary.
It's a river, I mean, just a ton of history around it, right? It's an easy place to fall in love with, from, you know, the Native Americans to the mountain men to Powell to, you know, just there's a ton of kind of American history around it.
Yeah.
And the resource that all of those people have been using it for hundreds of years, thousands of years.
Yeah, thousands of years, yeah. I was going to say. Yeah. is the green there, I mean, and from this point forward, we'll talk about, you know, the tailwater fishery that you fish. Is it an all-season fishery?
It is, absolutely. There is no, in Utah, we actually don't have a fishing season any longer. And that's been, oh man, at least probably 40 years to date myself a little bit since I was born, I'm pretty sure. At least I don't recall it ever having one. It did at one point where Utah would close down and actually have a fishing season. But no, we're year-round, and the green fish is year-round. And actually, you know, the wintertime can fish really good if you're willing to brave the cold. The streamer fishing is hit or miss, but if you catch one of those days where the streamer bites on, it can be an absolute riot. And fishing streamers out here on the green can almost be as visual as fishing dry flies. You actually, at least from a boat, you can watch fish chase your fly all the way to the boat. It's so much fun when it's like that.
Wow.
And last Saturday, I was down at Little Hole, and there wasn't a car in the parking lot at around
Had it all to yourself, huh?
Had it all to myself. Pretty neat.
So. Yeah, yeah. Now, does it turn into kind of, well, streamer and midge-type fishing in the wintertime?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Yep. You start getting temps over 30 degrees, and you'll have these midge hatches. And depending on the weather and the conditions, those hatches can be pretty prolific. And you can have some excellent midge fishing out here in the wintertime. Swinging little soft tackles. I've really enjoyed that over the years out here in the wintertime for those fish. Fishing the dry fly for them, too.
Nice. If someone comes out to fish the green, what weight rod would you suggest? And what kind of line?
Weight forward line and a 5-weight rod is probably ideal for, and that'll be the most versatile rod to bring out here. You can fish, you know, the green has a lot of hatches where you can fish very small aquatic insects. And then the green has size 4 Mormon crickets that show up and you're throwing the biggest dry fly you've ever seen out there, you know. So I think a 5-weight can do everything. If you're fishing from a boat, I would recommend to have a 5-weight that's a little bit on the fat side, a little bit stiffer. You're going to be making a little bit longer cast than if you're fishing from the shore. So that's where I would say like a soft 6 or a fast 5 for boat fishing. Shore fishing, I think a 5-weight's perfect.
Okay. I'm going to read a couple of questions here, but I'm going to have you postpone your answers because I'd like to address them by each section of the river. Because, as I know, but many people may not know, that there's like 3 sections of the green that you fish, and that's the way people talk about them and so forth. But let me read these questions because 2 of our listeners are kind enough to send them in. One is, how accessible is the river to do-it-yourself anglers without a boat, from Matt in La Vida? And Steve Schramm in Petaluma, California, wrote, I've read conflicting fish mile counts for the green sections A and B. Please comment on the current counts and the overall trend. Also, could you comment on the average size trend for A and B sections? So, with those two there, let's start talking about each of the sections because they fish differently, they look different, and we should talk about them, give them their own identity, so to speak, right? So,
Yeah.
It's broken out into A, B, and C sections. Is that right, Matt?
Yes, sir.
Yeah. And let's talk about section A first and tell us where it starts and where it ends.
So section A, we would consider that from the dam to Little Hole. And that section is 7.2 miles. And that is kind of the, all those pictures you see of that emerald colored water and the big canyon, that is that primarily the A sections.
Yeah, the topography is steep, red canyons, right? Just gorgeous.
Yes, that is correct. Although it's not sandstone. It is red rock, but it's actually not that southern Utah type sandstone that we get in Zion's Canyon or anything like that. But yeah, but it's obviously red, hence the name Flaming Gorge.
Right.
It's got that name from... You know, but looks like it's on fire sometimes. And that section also has the highest fish density due to it being directly below the dam.
How long is that? Is that a float you do from Flaming Gorge to Little Hole, and then do some people just float that and pull out?
Yeah, from the dam to Little Hole. That is definitely the most utilized section on the river, for sure. Most of the rafts, most of the fishing pressure, it seems like, is up there on A. You probably get half as much pressure on the B section and maybe a third of that pressure less on the C section again.
Okay. Okay.
If I had to guess, just throwing out rough numbers there. But, yeah.
On the float on A section, how long does that take on a standard float? And do you get out and do some wading, or are you totally fishing from the boat? How does that work?
Ooh, that's a great question. I love doing some of both. I always carry a wade fishing pack in my boat, and I love getting clients out of the boat and targeting fish. I just have so many great memories of doing that with clients, primarily in April during the blueing olive hatch, which that hatch in April is just prolific out here, and we just get blanket hatches of blueing olives. And getting clients out of the boat, that hatch is really set up for wade fishing and targeting a pod of fish that's up. So that's a great time to get clients out of the boat and wade fish a little bit, as well as kind of to the next question as far as the DIY in it. There's 7.2 miles of great trail, well-maintained trail, all the way from Little Hole to the dam, and there's some spectacular wade fishing to be done through there and sight fishing. I think as a young man, I used to come out here when I was in high school, camp in the back of the truck, and walking up that trail and looking at all the big fish in the water definitely kind of shaped my life and kind of steered me in the direction that I've went with my career.
Yeah, yeah. I don't know if you said it and I missed it. How long is that float? Is it, can you make a day out of it?
Seven point two miles. Yeah, that's a full. You can make that float into a full day.
Full day.
For sure.
Okay. Okay. Yeah. Okay.
We have a lot of back eddies. That's one thing that's so cool about the green is you have a lot of, you have pocket water. You have those long dry fly flats. You have those riffles. You have back eddies. There's just so much different water to fish.
Yeah.
And Emmett Heath, one of the first guys out here, always said, there isn't any bad water on the green. There's good and better.
Nice to know.
Good and better water.
Good and better. Sounds good. Yeah. Let's take a quick break here, and then we'll come back and we'll talk more about that Section A. There's a lot more things I'd like to know about that. So hang tight here. Matt, we'll be right back. The Ugly Bug Fly Shop in Casper, Wyoming has been serving fly fishers in Wyoming and around the world since 1983. Their selection of top-of-the-line gear and a huge assortment of flies is one of the best in the land. All products are available in their fly shop and online. Looking for advice? Just give them a call and their expert professional staff will help you with whatever you need. Visit the Ugly Bug Fly Shop today at uglybugflyshop.com or you can call them at 866-845-9284. Again, it's the uglybugflyshop.com or call them at 866-845-9284. You're listening to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio. We're talking with Matt Lucas about drifting the Green River. If you'd like to ask Matt a question, just go to our homepage at askaboutflyfishing.com and use that Q&A section to send us your question. We'll receive your question immediately. We'll try to answer as many of them as possible on the show tonight. So, Matt, I always ask my guest, hey, what's going on in your fly fishing world? Tell us about your business and anything else you got going.
Okay.
I thought I lost you there.
No. Sorry. I didn't know where to start. Yeah, okay. So we're kind of middle of the road as far as the size of a guide service out here on the green, at least. We have about 10 guys, which is kind of a perfect size crew for us. We also run shuttles out here and have a small fly shop. We probably do the most lower river floats out of any of the companies on the B section. My guys love going down there. And then we also probably do the most camp trips out here on the green, which is one of the best ways to experience the river and what it has to offer. We've been in business. Steve Schmidt actually started Western Rivers Fly Fisher Guides out here on the green in 86, and I purchased that permit from him 10 years ago. So been running it since. Yeah, going into season 11. Pretty exciting.
Yeah, it sounds like it. Yeah, I know my, then that's one of the ways we got connected is my son went up and fished with you guys, or he's fished up there twice, I think, and he did one of the camp trips. He said it was just incredible, and that the service was just incredible. He had a wonderful time. So, yeah. What's your website address so people can find you if they want to use your service?
Yeah, so it's wrsguides.com.
Okay, wrsguides.com.
That'll take you to our website. And yeah, if they want to email me directly about any questions, and whoever wins that float trip at the end of this, they can reach out to me at wrfguides@gmail.com.
Right. wrfguides@gmail.com. Good.
Yes, sir.
Well, good. Well, thanks for sharing that. Yeah. So back to section A. One of the questions is, what species of fish are we fishing for there, and what's the average size?
Yeah, the average size is kind of a hard one to answer. That depends what guide boat you're in for the day. You know how guides are. They all have different measuring tapes. But
oh, yeah, that's right. Yeah. Some are longer, some are shorter. Yeah, I know.
Yeah, it can depend on the tip, too, you know, that clients give us based on how big some of those fish are. But, no, you know, the average fish out here is around 16 inches, I would say, depending on what section you're fishing. But just generally, it's around 15 to 16 inches. And, yeah, there's mainly browns, rainbows, and there's some Colorado River cuts. So the fish that's actually native to this drainage.
Yeah, you had sent me the 2023 Green River sampling summary from, is this from?
Division of Wildlife.
Yeah, okay. Yeah. I thought that was interesting. And the, because we did have questions about that, but I think we're going to address those later. So is it primarily more rainbows up in Section A than browns? And then it kind of starts switching the other way as you go further down into the other sections? Or am I wrong about that?
So Kell Race, which is just below the dam, when they actually did their sampling summary, they came up with 83% browns, 14% rainbows, and then a remaining of 3% mountain whitefish is what turned up at their Kell Race sampling. Little hole, so a little bit further down, the browns were 61%, rainbows 15%, cutthroat 1%, mountain whitefish 21%, and then other. So, yeah, kind of interesting. I was actually surprised by that sampling up at the Kell Race as well, with that many browns being up there. So,
yeah, I was always under the impression that, you know, the browns liked the water a little warmer and the rainbows liked it a little colder. And so, but that those numbers don't tell that story. The rainbow, I mean, 83% up at the top and for that little hole, 61% browns. I mean, that's a, so the other, what's happening, it looks like the rainbows stay about the same, 14 and 15%, but that other comes into play, which is whitefish, cutthroats, and other, whatever other is. Interesting.
So, yeah, you're going to have some of those suckers in that. We even have some carp. And, you know, down on the lower reaches, we also have some smallmouth bass. We also have some pike. So, yeah, there's definitely a mixed bag. And the further you move away from the dam, the more opportunities you have at some of those other species for sure. So,
yeah,
the browns out here just seem to do extremely well. And you can also see the trout composition on that same document, Roger, and kind of see the quality of fish all the way from 97 to 2023. So 1997 all the way through 2023. And that's a very interesting chart as far as, like, the quality of fish that's out here, both at the Tail Race and Little Hole. So,
Is this something that people could get if they wanted to? I mean, is this online that is?
Absolutely. They're paying for this by buying a fishing license. This is all public information, and would love to share this information with anyone that's interested in seeing it. And our fisheries biologist out here, Ryan Mosley, has just always done such a great job with managing the resource, I feel like. And we actually just lost him. We didn't lose him. He moved. He didn't pass away.
Oh.
I'm sorry.
Okay.
I didn't want to imply that.
Okay.
He moved and took a job in another area, which is unfortunate because I feel like he really did a great job. But that document really has some interesting information in it as far as trout condition, you know, average length, density, answers kind of a lot of questions that some of the folks sent in.
Yeah. One of them was fish counts, too. Has that changed over the years, or up, down?
Yeah, it's significantly decreased. You know, it's probably, I would say, to answer kind of that question as far as fish per mile currently, I would say it's roughly around 5,000 fish per mile.
Okay.
Which is still a very big number. But at one point we had, it's down probably almost 50% from what it was at probably its highest point, which is just almost too many fish. And that's kind of what the biologist finally found, is that the resource couldn't sustain that high of a density of fish year over year. And that's kind of the direction they ended up heading, is actually stocking less fish, and then they ended up getting better and better quality fish, which I've definitely seen over the years. Once we kind of went over that hump, so anytime you have a dam go in, you all of the, what do I want to call it, proteins in the water that come from the dam, at some point those start to lessen after that dam's been created. So there's a huge boom in aquatic insect and life right after they put the penstocks in, and then they had an incredible fishery with, you know, I would say back then the average fish size was probably close to 18 inches, which is just incredible. And then they had also extremely high densities. But now, as it's kind of leveled off, both the reservoir and the nutrients coming from that reservoir within the resource or the river below that, I feel like we've found kind of a good carrying capacity where we have quality fish and still a good density, if that makes sense. I'm really happy with how the fishery's been managed currently.
Good.
With stocking, we're seeing really quality fish year after year.
Yeah, I noticed in reading that report that they are, you know, they're constantly experimenting too. It's like they said they put one strain of cutthroats in. That didn't work out. Now they're trying another one, and that they started stocking larger rainbows so that they didn't get eaten by the large browns. So I thought, okay, well, all that makes sense, you know.
There is so much predation on those smaller planted rainbows from those big browns, which occasionally they still do that, where a hatchery will actually not be able to offload their fish in time, or they have a truck going somewhere and they can't stock, and we'll get a whole bunch of small fish like that. And talk about a few days of really good streamer fishing, Roger. It can be it can be like that.
I think we had a question come in on the, hold on here, let me grab this on the internet. Yeah, Phil McCartney in Kentucky, he wrote in, when and where are the green are streamers a reasonable choice to fish? Is there a forage base that those of us who like to fish streamers can point to as justification for doing what we would do in any case? So sounds like Phil likes streamer fishing.
Yeah, Phil would love the green. I think you can, I don't know, I have yet to be able to really put my finger on why some days they're just on the streamer bite, and other days you get a lot of short strikes and a lot of follows, but they just won't commit to the fly. And I've tried to figure out if it's weather dependent, high or low pressures. It's just, there's no, as far as I'm concerned, there's really no trend to that or anything I can put my finger on that's consistent. Moon phases, any of that. It's always, there's just no rhyme or reason. Some days they are just on that streamer. It could be they get a hatch of fresh fry. Either we have a lot of sculpin, whitefish, all of that. And Fluctuation in flow is always a good time to fish a streamer as well out here. Whenever we have a decrease or increase, all of those fish are relocating and resetting, trying to find a new holding lie or feeding lie. So that can displace the smaller fish as well, which creates for some good streamer fishing. And other than that, though, like this time of year when they have fairly consistent flows throughout the day, one day you can go out and just they're eating it every third or fourth cast, and then the next day you go out, very similar conditions, and you don't catch near as many, which is kind of I've found to be the case with streamers.
What about the different sections? Does one section fish better with streamers than another?
I love fishing the A section with streamers, honestly. At one time, you can have two or three fish chasing your fly, and they're all, like, running over the top of each other trying to get to the fly first, and you get to see it all from the boat. It's absolutely fantastic. That's what I mean, the streamer fishing out here can just be so much fun when you have good water clarity and good sun to be able to see into that water. It can be a blast.
Yeah, I have to say, having fished the Green, it is one of the clearest rivers that I've ever fished. So when you say, yeah, you can see the fish coming, it's because, you know, you've got like 20 feet of clarity in the water that you can see through. Yeah. You know,
it's a blessing and a curse,
yeah.
Roger.
Right.
You know, I watch a lot of flies get pulled away from fish every summer because it's so visual, and you have to just wait and wait and wait, and you get to see that fish move several feet to eat that fly.
Yeah,
so
that's a hard habit to break. I remember fishing down in Belize, and we were casting into the mangroves for tarpon, and it was my first experience doing that. And so I'm stripping in this streamer pattern, and I see this tarpon come up, and his mouth opens up, you know, those bucket mouths, right?
Yeah.
And he opens up, and I can see him ready to take my fly, and I think he's got it, so I strip strike, right? And the guy goes, no, no, not yet, no, no. And, of course,
yep.
I missed it. I was too anxious, you know, and just stripped it right out of his mouth is what I did. And so that was a good lesson, though. It taught me early on, you know, wait for it. But anyway, yeah,
yep.
Same thing with the browns down there in the rainbows, I'm sure. Well, okay, we've been talking about, well, one other question that Phil wrote in here on the internet that I wanted to get because you had kind of mentioned it a couple of times is, he says, at what release levels from the dam should someone look for other water to fish instead of the Green? In such a case, what opportunities might Flaming Gorge Reservoir offer, or are there better options? So how much does the flow actually affect the fishing there? I know, like, down on the White River in Arkansas, it's a big deal. Because that river can gum up like a couple of feet or something.
Yeah.
Do you?
And they can. They can fluctuate the Green in a similar way. Typically they don't, just to try to help, mainly to help us out. But occasionally they'll need a bump of power and need to run those generators a little hotter and have to send a little more water down. And I've also seen them dang near shut it off. So, yeah, it can negatively impact the fishery. I think the biggest thing that most folks want to watch for when they're coming out in the flows is a significant change. Is fishing right on that change? And if it's going up over 1,000 CFS bigger than it has previously, then that's going to throw a lot of debris and break up a lot of moss and send a lot of stuff downstream, and typically it takes a day for that to kind of reset and clean up a little bit. 1,000 to 1,500 probably of new CFS can negatively impact it. It definitely starts to impact. That definitely has even more of an effect when the river has stayed low and then comes up, because then you have all of that debris on that bank. If that, hopefully that kind of makes sense. The other thing is like a big bump day after day where it starts to climb. And then anything over around 5,000 CFS really starts to change the back eddies, how you set up for the rapids, all of that. I think Red Creek Rapid at 6,600 CFS 6,000 to 60,000, 65,000, that rapid is as sharp as it gets at that flow, meaning that it's the most difficult and scary to go through.
Do you get warnings or anything when they're going to release large amounts?
Yeah, the Greendale, the USGS Greendale site's the best site to watch, and WAPA and the USGS will be posting. You can actually go onto that site and also look at historical data and kind of get a feel for when you're going to see those big bumps. Like the end of May is when they typically do that simulated runoff, and then they do a smallmouth bass bump in kind of around mid-June now. And you can kind of look back through the historical data on that USGS and see when those kind of happen. Those are our two biggest events where you're going to see a huge fluctuation. Hmm. Based on snowpack, that may last 5 to 7 days, or it could last, you know, 2 to 3 weeks, depending on how much snow and how much we need to pass down to Lake Powell and the lower reaches. So, that fluctuation can be good if it's small, like I was talking about with displacing those smaller bayfish.
Right.
It's probably around 1,000 to 2,000 CFS. If you're seeing a bump like that, it's going to be too much based on how much time you're seeing that bump occur over. If it's several hours, then that's, you know, not that significant. If they're doing a big bump every hour, then you're going to want to fish in front and behind that by several hours. If it's going up every day and ends up getting out of its banks, then you're talking 3 or 4 days before it fishes very well, unless you're fishing unless you're willing to clean off moss off your flies a lot.
So we're still on section A here. What is the best way to fish this section? I mean, when you're guiding there, are you nymphing? Are you dry fly fishing? Are you streamer fishing? Or do you mix it all up? Or what, you know, how does the day go?
You know, I think the Green is just so special because we get to fish dry flies out here really 365 days a year. You can catch fish on the Green with dry flies, which is just incredible, and have some of the best dry fly fishing of your life out here. As far as, like, you know, my favorite way to fish it is definitely with a dry fly. Streamer's probably secondary, but all of that's probably from a boat for the most part, except for PMDs and blue wings. I love getting out of the boat and fishing from shore and targeting, like, pods of fish, one particular fish from the bank during those hatches. Yeah,
okay.
A lot of fun.
Okay, okay. So nymphing was last on your list then. Okay, that's really interesting. And when you say dry fly fishing, are you talking about matching the hatch, or are you talking about attractor patterns? Or, I mean, also on the Green, we've got the crickets and the cicadas, right, which is dry fly fishing.
Yeah, I mean, this is where the Chernobyl ant got its name and where it was created. And, yeah, it's these fish out here love eating big terrestrials, and our fishery is just is perfect for that. And it's so much fun with these big browns out here. They always have one eye on the surface. So, yeah, there's very few guide days where I'm not fishing dress, at least for 50% of the day, if not more. So,
wow.
Yeah.
Wow. The dry fly fishers are going to love to hear that. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
And so it sounds like that's very productive then, too. Are you fishing to the banks then, or how do you dry fly fish there?
That's a good question. Yeah, all of the above. It's so much fun drifting a cricket along those grassy overhung banks down on sea. Or we have prolific flying hatches. When we get those afternoon thunderstorms and the ground temperatures come up, we'll just get gobs of flying ants, and when they hit the water, the fish just can't leave them alone. So it really kind of depends. Like, we're fishing the banks a lot with the terrestrials, obviously. That's where those bugs come from, is off of the bank. And then we're also fishing a lot of the mid-river flats, especially with, like, the cicada patterns, right? Those bugs are trying to fly across the river, hearing each other clicking on the other side of the river, which is their mating call, and then they end up getting blown into the water. So, you know, I love fishing a lot of those mid-river flats as well as the banks, which is so much fun.
Yeah.
But yeah, then the smaller aquatic insects that we have, the Sally's fishing a lot of riffle drops with those types of bugs, PMDs, you know, down on the lower rivers, getting those good PMD hatches in those glassy, long, slicked off flats is just, and seeing noses up from bank to bank is so much fun. So yeah, it all fishes really good. Hitting the back eddies, like that's one thing too, like we're known for out here is fishing all of these back eddies that we have for suspended fish. And these fish may be over, you know, 15 feet of water, but they're only a foot underneath and they're just stacked in there like cordwood sometimes during certain hatches on these seams. And yeah, posting the boat up or targeting them from shore can be a blast.
Yeah. Time to take another quick break, but hang tight here, Matt, and we'll be right back. Discover the power of pure skagit with Olympic Peninsula Skagit Tactics. From delicate soft tackles to hefty steelhead flies, OPST's versatile casting system meets the demands of every angling situation. With Ed Ward's unparalleled skagit rod design and casting expertise, OPST offers a quicker route to mastering effective casting techniques. Whether battling wind and rain or targeting steelhead trout or smallmouth bass, trust OPST's innovative rods, lines, and tips to elevate your fishing experience. Join the ranks of skilled anglers who rely on OPST for consistency, proficiency, and a superior fly fishing adventure. Unleash your potential with OPST today. Visit pureskagit.com or call them at 206-858-8476. Again, that's pureskagit.com or call them at 206-858-8476. You're listening to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio. We're talking with Matt Lucas about drifting the Green River. If you'd like to ask Matt a question, go to our homepage and fill that form out, send it on over, and we'll see if we can't get it answered for you. Okay, a couple questions came in on the Internet here, Matt. Bob Nunn in New Jersey says, on the camping trips, what wildlife might be seen or encountered, such as deer, brown bears, reptiles, otter, beaver? What might he see?
See a lot of bighorn sheep out here. We see moose. Only seen a few elk from the river. There's definitely driving back and forth. We're actually in a limited entry elk unit. There's definitely a lot of elk and deer out here. Definitely seeing, I mean, we have a lot of deer and elk right in town, kind of similar to Estes Park that way.
Yeah,
on the river, lots of beavers, tons of herons, tons of osprey, a lot of eagles, a lot of hawks, raptors. We see a bunch of river otters, which are so much fun to see on the water, canyon wrens, to a number of waterfowl species, ducks, geese. Yeah, it kind of really depends on, we get a variety throughout the year. You know, the herons and the osprey definitely migrate through. We kind of have eagles all year, but definitely see an influx of those osprey and heron in the spring.
Okay. Greg Vester in St. Louis, Missouri wrote in and says, which is more prominent, mayflies or caddis?
Anymore, I'd definitely say mayflies.
Yeah. Do you get any caddis on the river? Or?
We do. Yeah, definitely have a lot of caddis. But our mayfly hatches can be just prolific.
Yeah.
And our PMDs are definitely gaining traction. Those kind of ebb and flow. There's actually some really good research out there from the Utah Bug Lab that did some research out here on aquatic insect invertebrates on the Green and where their numbers have been at for probably the last 5 to 10 years. But so some of those numbers are out there, but we can get really good caddis hatches, basically from mid-June all the way through July, August, and even into September. They kind of ebb and flow and show back up all along the river corridor. I think, I'd still say that our blueing hatch and then kind of second to that is the PMD hatch for just overall densities. Okay. We also get a lot of trichos and a lot of pseudos.
Okay. One thing that my son mentioned in fishing the river is, and I want to bring this up so that people, when they come out, go, you know, fish with whoever makes sense to fish with. But as I've listened to you tonight, you know, you really kind of sounds like your guide service caters to the fly fisher, the person that really wants to enjoy the art and science of fly fishing. But he told me about another technique that I guess some guides are using on the river called bouncing, I guess it is. And maybe you can explain to me what that is and who that is. Maybe it, you know, I mean, maybe people want to steer away from that. Maybe they like that. It's all up to them. But can you kind of explain what that technique is? Because I've not experienced it anywhere else. So,
yeah, I mean, typically it's a type of a, it would be considered like a nymph rig where they're fishing. They actually have a balloon up top and then have weight on the bottom with tags tied off to, they can now fish three flies in Utah off of that main running line. And yeah, they're typically just fishing that out of the boat. Yeah, it's an extremely productive way to fish the river, and those guys are catching a lot of fish. We take a little bit different approach. We typically, when we're nymph fishing, are fishing a inline rig that's easy to false cast and still using, you know, mainly the fly line to load the rod and to cast that rig. In addition to that, which, you know, may not outfish a bounce rig some of the days, but is fishing dries, dry droppers, swung flies, and really trying to follow those insects up through the water column, match the hatch, and target specific fish, mm-hmm. opposed to just, you know, overall quantities.
Yeah.
Really kind of choosing the way we not only want to fish, but also how we want to catch those fish.
Right.
And the process we want to use to do that. And I think that's one thing, like, it's kind of, it's something that everyone, yeah, needs to make a decision about. You know, I think if people are unaware of what that is and that style, they need to decide if that's what they want to do. And there's a lot of outfitters out there that do that, and all the power to them. It's just something or a technique that we don't use at Western Rivers.
Yeah. Yeah. It sounds like kind of a dredging operation. You're going deep, not much casting involved. And, which makes it, like you say, it's, with all the weight in the balloon, the hook kind of sets itself. And it sounds like a lot of the art of fishing is taken away from that in my mind. But yeah, again, in, you know, and before the show, we were talking about that because we were talking about, you know, wherever you go to fish with a guide, you should ask them how they fish, what they use, what their techniques are, how a day goes, so that, you know, expectations are set properly. And I think that's important no matter where you go to fish. But
I mean, I've been on some awful guide trips. I try to get guides whenever I go somewhere new, honestly, and been guided a lot. And I love doing that. And I think everybody has something to offer. But I also feel like it's extremely important to make sure that your ethics and your views and your expectations for how and what a guide's going to be doing aligns with yours. And if you know what that is, or if it's more of a blank canvas, then that may not matter as much. But if you do have particular wants or needs, I would definitely tell these folks that are listening that they need to make sure that that's what's going to be happening on the trip and who they're booking,
right,
and who they're booking with.
Right.
Okay. Regardless of the style or what they want to do, just making sure that's how they're going to get a successful guide day and be happy with the outcome. It just continues to become more and more expensive to get guides. And when it goes bad, it seems like it goes really bad, which I think most of the guide companies are trying to avoid, and certainly the customer.
Yeah, Chuck in Placerville, California wrote in, and this directly relates. He says, as a guide, many factors are out of your control. Some days are great and some are tougher. How do you set realistic expectations with your clients?
Undersell and over-deliver.
That's always the best way to do business. But
You know, that's kind of, yeah. And I think you can do that in a lot of ways. You know, I think even if the fishing's tough, we've all heard it, a bad day fishing is better than a good day at work, right? But at the exact same time, I think it's having those conversations and setting an expectation the night before or even that the morning of the trip, being up front and talking to them about the realities that are fluctuating flows, changing weather patterns, barometers, a blown out tributary, whatever that may be, right? And we're fly fishermen, and so we're all optimistic. I think that's the one thing we all have in common, regardless if you, however you like to fish.
Mm-hmm.
I think we're all very optimistic, and we still want to go fish. I think most of those people, at the end of the day, if they were standing in the parking lot with their gear on and you told them it was awful fishing, they'd still want to climb in the boat.
Yeah.
You know, and it's the best thing we can do as guides, I think, is go out there, work hard, be positive. And I think we always, typically, even though somebody's, a client of ours has probably fished for longer, they definitely don't have as many days on the water on that piece or on that body of water that we do. So we always have something that we can offer or share.
Right.
And then again, we always have something we can learn from them too. So
right.
I think there's always an opportunity there to go show a client a good day, even though the fishing may be tough, and make it about all of those other things that we love fly fishing for, the
yeah.
outdoors,
yeah.
the flora, the fauna, which sometimes gets overlooked,
yeah.
I feel like.
Yeah.
And those are the days where it can become really important to know those types of things, and it can still be a great day outside with friends.
Right. Jason Stacy in Kentucky wrote in, he says, could someone who is experienced with drifting in general, but not the grain, do it safely, or should they go with a guide a few times first?
It would definitely help to go with a guide first. I think any body of water, it definitely helps to have that type of insight. That being said, the Green is in an extremely technical body of water for not having a rapid class higher than a 3. We see a ton of boats get lost out here every year, guide boats, including general public boats. There's definitely been a lot of times where there's been a loss of life. And so I like that he's even asking that question, because it needs to be taken extremely serious out here with fluctuating flows. Even if it's low, there's even more exposed rocks. And then if it's really high, there's some really serious holes that you can get sucked into and lose boats extremely quick.
Okay.
So I think with that being said, yes, you can come out here and DIY it and be okay. If you have the ability to get a guide, I would highly recommend it.
Where is there is one class 3 rapid, right, that I remember?
There is. Yep.
And where is that? Is that in the section A, B? I can't remember.
It is in section B, and it's about halfway through that section, which that section is approximately 9 miles down to
okay.
Indian Crossing. So, and B section is from Little Hole, where the A section ends, so Little Hole boat ramp, down to Indian Crossing or Taylor Flats Bridge, which those two takeouts are a half a mile apart, approximately.
Okay. Okay.
So,
and
yeah, Red
is
Creek's
that
about right in the middle.
Would that be a full day's float then as well, like the upper section?
Yeah. Yep. For
so
sure.
So when somebody comes up to fish the Green, how does the conversation go about the different sections? I mean, it doesn't sound like you could effectively fish the A and B section in a day, right? Unless you float the whole thing fast.
Yeah, we actually do quite a few A, B floats, which kind of brings up another topic. But the AB float, we have an organization out here. There's some stipulations as far as guides running AB floats and where they start and stop on an AB float. We have a association out here amongst all of the guides called GROGA, Green River Outfitters and Guides Association. And we actually have, it's kind of unwritten, it's more of a gentleman's agreement between all of the outfitters of where we start and stop our day on AB floats. So we're supposed to push all the way down to a roller coaster rapid, which is about halfway through A, before we start fishing on an AB. And then fish from roller coaster rapid all the way down to Red Creek Rapid, or right where that class 3 rapid is at. And then your day is done from there, and then you're rowing out. So it still makes for an extremely long day, almost 16 miles worth of water, but you're only fishing that middle piece, which helps spread out guys up and down the river corridor a little bit better. So it's definitely a good option.
So it sounds like you're fishing kind of half, the lower half of A and the upper half of B?
Yes, that's correct.
And then you're just traveling on the top end and the bottom end to complete the trip. Yeah. Yeah. Okay. That's good to know. Yeah. I'm glad I asked that question because I can't remember when we did it, what we did. But so talking about section B, does the topography around the river change from Little Hole down, or is it similar?
It does. Yeah. You kind of come out of the real kind of canyon section to where you get into more kind of open valley or basins, parks down on the lower reaches. It stays, you're pretty much kind of in, once you get below Little Hole and technically on B, you're somewhat still at the tail end of the canyon until you get to Red Creek, and then it drastically changes about a mile or two below Red Creek where you start to come into what's called Brown's Park, and it really starts to open up down there for on that bottom half of the B section.
Now, Brown's Park, that's got some history, right?
Yes, sir. It's still fairly lawless down there.
It's still fairly lawless. How great.
Some awesome country. I love Brown's Park. There's a ton of history down there. Yeah.
Outlaws or something holding up there. Yeah. Yeah. I thought there was something like that.
There's a really cool historical site down there called Jarvie Ranch. That's a fantastic place to eat a lunch and walk around.
Oh, cool. Now, still fishing for browns and rainbows in that section?
I don't want to say on that lower part of B, you're almost getting even more browns.
Mm-hmm.
The brown to rainbow ratio drastically changes, I feel like, below Red Creek Rapid.
And so we are getting more browns. I remember something about the lower you go, the more browns there were. So it's
fewer
that,
fish, it's, bigger fish.
Fewer and bigger, yeah. Okay. Yeah. And what's the best way to fish this section, B section?
Size 4 Mormon cricket along the bank.
making it sound easy, you know? It's like most fly fishers just dream of days of throwing big things like that out there.
I think we're extremely spoiled out here on the green. We get to do that more days than not. And I realize how fortunate we are in that. But yeah, it's such a special fishery as far as that goes. Yeah, that hatch the last few years has just been incredible. And I've had so much fun watching those fish. They're like actively moving up and down the bank, targeting those crickets. It's just kind of wild down there when those crickets are trying to migrate across the river. So, yeah,
is there a particular time of year for the crickets and or the cicadas?
I would say like mid-June on for crickets, which that hatch is just completely at random. It's almost like if they migrate through and end up hitting the river corridor. We had them for, 2.5-3 months last year where they just kind of hung around and we kept just getting waves of crickets coming through. We'd think it would end and then would get another wave of crickets. And the year before was also excellent. But I hadn't seen a cricket hatch prior to that in almost 8 years, So it's kind of hit or miss. The cicadas aren't consistent, yet the cicadas are more consistent than the crickets. And the cicadas, we usually know by mid-June if we're going to have a cicada year or not.
Okay. And
if we haven't seen them by then, we're probably not going to get many.
Do the fish have a memory of these crickets and cicadas? In other words, even if it's an off year or off month, do they remember what a good meal that was, so to speak?
I think so. Yeah, I think these fish, that big of a food source for them year after year definitely, I think, plays a role in that where, fishing a black foam, Chernobyl, anything can be a really good call midsummer out here on the green. that's never a bad choice to put on a, you know, big foam terrestrial
Yeah.
and fish it either on the bank or down the middle.
Right.
And usually produces.
Okay. Kevin McIntyre wrote in and said, says, how do you adapt to the fishery when the river gets pressured and fish are more hesitant to bite? Do you change up the presentation or fly pattern or toss a curveball and add a blade to your fly?
I think tying your own flies makes a significant difference out here on the green. Having something that's a little bit different than what's in the bin at the fly shop can really give you an edge for sure. And I've seen that firsthand. And it can just be a slight change to one of those patterns, a little bit different colored dubbing, a little bit different wing, something that they're not seeing all of the time can really produce more fish.
Okay. Phil in Salt Lake City says, Matt, do you think anything needs to be done with the overfishing that is happening? I've been floating the green for over 35 years and have watched the quality of the fishing decline a little bit more each year.
Yeah, I guess even due to that DWR report, like the fish quality, fish density is going down, fish quality is going up based on that sampling summary. Like, I think it's all kind of relative. I think I understand what's at the heart of that question, though, and that's how busy all of our rivers and streams are getting. And I really like that question. I think it's a question we all have to have. It's a question I ask myself all the time as an outfitter that's making a profit off of a resource. And am I having a positive effect or am I having a negative impact? And, you know, we kind of talked about this a few days ago, Roger, where, you know, introducing people that haven't been out here before creates more individuals that'll stand up and fight for a resource if it needs it. And I think there's pros and cons to both sides. And it is. I think it's something all of us need to ask ourselves because every one of us is responsible for creating more pressure on all of these rivers. And, you know, we've probably all mentored somebody into the sport and helped them get into it. So we all have a negative impact. But we can also have an extremely positive impact. And I think it's a matter of finding that balance and what that is. How many fish is enough to catch in a day to where you're having a negative impact on the resource or, you know, you've caught enough and you walk away.
Yeah.
And having those types of conversations with ourselves about what our ethics are as we approach the sport and it becomes busier and busier.
Yeah, I'm just doing I'm just curious here. I just jumped out in the chat GPT. Because it sounds like Phil is, you know, probably my age. Maybe not. But, you know, when you fished for 35 years, I mean, you were only 5 years old, so, Matt. So, I mean,
yes,
you
sir.
Were probably fishing, but, you know, you see a lot of change. And I just went into ChatGPT and put in, what was the estimated world population in 1968 versus 2023? Because in 1968, you know, I was in grade school and fishing in Alaska. Well, 1968, there were 3.55 billion people in the world. Now there are 8.05 billion people in the world. So almost,
yeah, more than
doubled
it.
Yeah.
Right?
So, you know, right there just tells you where the pressure's coming from. And fishing will never be like it was in 1968 just because that factor alone. But anyway, yeah. Well, good answer. Good answer, Matt, to that. We're running short on time here, so we got to finish up with Section B. Oh, and before I go into Section B, what are the camping opportunities in Section A and B, or where do you guys usually camp? Do you have designated areas for the guides, or are you camping in public camp areas and just reserve like everybody else, or how does that work?
Yep, outfitters got to reserve just like everybody else.
Okay.
And that can be done on rec.gov. And then there is no camping on the A section. You cannot camp
okay.
until you get below Little Hole on B. And the first camp is Stonefly. And then they kind of go downriver all the way through the C section and just keep going. So then there's river camps from there all the way down.
So do you,
so, yeah.
When you do a camp, When you do a camp trip, do you usually stay out like 2 nights or something then, and then fish A, B, and C, or how do you
Yeah,
schedule
I
that?
think one night, 2 days is too short. By the time you get in there and set up in camp and enjoy sitting around the fire and having a drink, it's over the next day. So I like the 2 day or 2 night, 3 day camps. I think that's kind of perfect. The 3 day or 3 night, 4 day are a little bit too long. I think both the guides and clients have all had a little bit too much sun. Not to try to talk people out of booking more days fishing, but I think that 2 night, 3 day is just right.
And do you fish A, B, and C then? Or how do
Yeah,
you work that?
typically over a 3 day float, you'll fish all three sections.
All
We like
three.
to leave camp and then come back around and put the boats in at Little Hole and do an afternoon float back into that same camp. That's kind of our favorite. That's our favorite time to fish. Upper B is in the afternoon because it does not see very much pressure that time of day because it's such a long float. Nobody's fishing that lower river that time, and you usually have it to yourself, and you start to get a smattering of caddis coming back or coming off the water and some pretty happy fish. So, yeah, it's fun. I love fishing that twilight back into camp, seeing that fire going and the lights on and smell the Dutch oven. So,
And then
yeah.
that section C, it starts where and goes where, and what's the topography like for that?
So it's actually the longest section. It goes all the way from Swinging Bridge all the way down to what's called, I'm sorry, it goes from Taylor Flats Bridge all the way down to Swinging Bridge. And yeah, that total section is 12 miles approximately. So down there, you actually go into another canyon. The first canyon you hit is called False Canyon, and then it opens up into another very small valley called Shangri-La, and then it goes into what's called Swallow Canyon. And that's where that red rock comes all the way down right into the water. And it's a really special place late afternoon when the light's coming off the water. It's way cool down there. Again, you continue to get fewer and fewer fish as you get further and further from the dam, but you can also find bigger and bigger fish.
More browns then again than rainbows,
Yes, sir.
as with
Yep.
the B
And down
section.
there, you almost get either, it's either a lot of small fish or big fish. It's kind of like the Henry's Fork in that way down there.
And do your fishing tactics change as you go to into that C section?
Yeah, depending on what bugs are hatching or if I'm fishing terrestrials. You know, there's fewer and fewer fish, so you're trying to get the attention of whatever's there and try to suck them either off that bank or off the bottom to come up and eat your fly. So I feel like,
Is
yeah,
the
I
water
kind of feel like the
is the
river changes in how I approach it on that lower part of C especially. And then again, it kind of changes halfway down B once you get below Red Creek and how I approach it. Yep. You know, the river's not as deep down there consistently as it is up on A and the top half of B. So yeah, like kind of those sections or those spots are kind of where I change tactics a little bit.
Do you is the water still clear down there? Do you do any sight fishing to fish for the larger fish?
Absolutely. Yeah, you can. It can be clear. It just depends what's happening with Red Creek. So Red Creek Rapid is named after Red Creek, which is a tributary that comes in right below that rapid, essentially. And when that blows out, they'll actually see it all the way down on the Colorado and know that Red Creek blew out because it puts in that much silt. You can't see a quarter inch into the water. It'll blow up that bad.
I remember we were doing a 21-day raft trip down the Colorado River in Grand Canyon. And one day we had done our run for the day, and we were just sitting on a big rock looking over the river, having a beer. And all of a sudden, the water was like, it was real clear for the Colorado there. And all of a sudden, it almost looked like one of those science fiction movies where, the bugs start coming or something. But the river just
Yeah.
started changing, like this cloud was going down the river, just changing. And I imagine Red Creek would be like that too when it blows out. It's really something to watch, actually. Not too good for fishing, but interesting to watch. We're
No,
running out of
it can
time
ruin
here,
a day
but
of fishing.
yeah. Jerry Sherman in Lexington, Kentucky wrote in and says, "With the Green and most other popular Western rivers overrun with drift boats, do you have a secret for continuing to be successful amidst all the traffic? And are there times when there's not so much pressure?"
Yeah, those shoulder seasons are a great time to get out there and fish. If you're looking to get away from pressure and have a fishery like this to yourself, there's more days than not throughout the winter that there's a good chance you'd be the only boat out there on the water. And we talk about, this river being, or a lot of rivers being pressured. A lot of that, I feel like, is a shrinking season somewhat. April for us used to be our busiest month out here on the Green for that blueing olive hatch. But anymore, it seems like everyone wants to be in shorts and flip-flops and fishing during nice weather, which is great. But that also comes with a lot of additional pressure. So I would probably encourage fishing it at different times of the day. That makes a big difference out here on the Green, doing afternoon launches. Sometimes we'll meet clients at 11 o'clock and fish them all the way until dark, which is probably has a fraction of the pressure and the boats on the water that time of night to meeting at 8 o'clock and putting on with everybody else on the mountain. So I would kind of take some of those things into consideration when you're actually launching and spending time on the water, because a lot of those really early, really late aren't getting hit or pressured as much, as well as those shoulder seasons. And then I think the other big thing with when fishing in pressure is that, fishing something a little bit different than what everyone else is throwing. And that basically happens by tying your own flies, which really can give an angler such an edge in a day and age where, everyone's buying the same fly in the same pattern. So spending some time behind the vise and spinning up something that is a similar pattern, but maybe just a slightly different color, different sexy floss legs can make all the difference.
Yeah, you had one last question, and then we'll call it quits for tonight. A few minutes ago, you had mentioned about the guides, like staggering, if you're doing an AB float, you kind of stagger the float, right? You wait and so forth. That to me, that's a good effort to control boat traffic and so forth on the river and to avoid crowding. What are the guides and outfitters up there on the Green doing as an organization to help preserve the river and its beauty and its productivity? Is there a concerted effort towards that? And if so, what is that effort?
We're definitely not doing enough. And, that's something we are trying to do. We're actually trying to get the Green River Conservancy up and running, which would be a nonprofit, which has been really pretty slow to start. It's been kind of 2 years in the making to try to get that up and running. But we've definitely come a long ways in the last year as far as that goes, but kind of hit somewhat of a roadblock. But that's one thing we're doing. We definitely try to stay involved, working with EWR on sampling and telling them what we're seeing, asking for hook scarring type information. The guides and GROGA, the Green River Outfitters and Guides Association, they do a river cleanup every year, and it has a really pretty good turnout. So we've cleaned all three. We actually have enough people where we've tried to clean all three sections each season, which is cool. And then I think the other thing we do is try to have meetings and invite the Forest Service, DNR, and talk with those folks about how the resource is being managed. And I think that's one thing everybody can do. The river's actually going is having a management plan revised, and final comments are due on the 24th of this month. So just a few days to make comments on that general plan, which have some pretty big potentially effects for additional crowding. There's some language in that in one of the drafts that they wanted to increase the size of parking lots, which just continues to support more vehicles and more pressure. So I think people can get involved with making comments to those types of things, which the Forest Service really likes to hear from the general public on those types of things. After they finalize the general plan, they'll actually be moving to the river and making a new river management plan. So making sure that folks are getting on and making their voices heard and their opinions heard with that can really, they can be a part of potentially changing, you know, how the river's managed and the amount of pressure on the river.
Yeah, yeah, sounds good. Sounds good. Well, unfortunately, we got to wrap it up. We've run over time, so I'll have to move quick here at the end. But stick with me here for a few more minutes, Matt, because we're going to give away some prizes. We're going to give away that one-year membership to Fly Fishers International, a one-year membership to Trout Unlimited, and give away that one-day float trip for two on the Green River with Western Rivers Fly Fisher Guides. So hang tight. We'll do that in just a moment. The Bonefish and Tarpon Trust works very hard to safeguard the future of our beloved flats fisheries, from protecting spawning sites threatened by unsustainable fishing pressure to securing historic funding to restore Florida's Everglades and estuaries. Thanks to their members, they've expanded their conservation to the Bahamas, Belize, and Mexico. There's still much more work to be done, and they need your help. With your support, they can ensure that the flats fishery is healthy and sustainable now and for generations to come. Visit btt.org and become a member of the Bonefish and Tarpon Trust today. Again, that's btt.org. Just a quick reminder to everyone, before you leave the website tonight, please take a minute and give us your feedback about the show. You can find a link on our homepage in the section under tonight's show. This is What Did You Think of the Show? Just click on that link, leave your comments. We'd really appreciate it. Now it's time to give away our prizes. And the winners of our drawings are randomly selected from the show's registration database. If you didn't register for tonight's show, it's too late now, but make sure you do so for our next show so you don't miss out on a chance to win some of these great prizes. If you are one of the lucky winners, we will contact you after the show to collect your information so that we can deliver your prize to you. So first, we'll be giving away a one-year membership to Fly Fishers International. To learn more about FFI, go to flyfishersinternational.org. Again, a great organization to support. If you don't win, go and join anyway. Our winner for that is Paul Schmidt in Washington. Paul Schmidt in Washington. So thanks, Paul, for listening and playing, and I know you'll enjoy your membership to FFI. Our second prize is for one-year membership to Trout Unlimited. To learn more about Trout Unlimited, go to tu.org. And again, great organization to support. Our winner for that is Chuck Reek, probably mispronouncing that, in California. So Chuck, congratulations too on your new membership to Trout Unlimited. And now for the grand prize, we're going to give away that one-day float trip for two on the Green River, courtesy of Western Rivers Fly Fisher Guides. Now, one thing I'm going to ask, I don't know if I've ever done this before, but if you don't think that you would actually take advantage of this trip, don't play, because you'll be removing that opportunity from somebody else. So if you honestly think that you would go out and take advantage of this, and I'm sure you'd turn it into a 2 or 3 day trip as well, but if you do think you take advantage, then please play and answer the question I'm going to ask. So you do this on the homepage of our website, where you could ask questions during the show in the text box. Put in your answer. First person that puts it in will win the trip. And this is going to be kind of a two-part question. We were talking about hatches. What's the number one hatch and what's the number two hatch on the river? Okay, so number one and number two hatch that Matt mentioned earlier in the show. So Matt, it takes just a pause for them to hear the question because there's a slight delay in the broadcast. And then, of course, they got to type in the answer. So we have to wait here a minute while I refresh the screen here. And first answer, Silas, Sally and PMDs. No, not quite right. I'm not going to tell you which one you got right. but the next answer is Blue Wing Olive and PMD. So I think that's correct. Is that correct, Matt?
Yes, sir. That is correct.
That's Greg Vester, St. Louis, Missouri. Greg Vester, St. Louis, Missouri. You just won yourself a trip down the Green River, so you need to get up there and do that, make arrangements. I will send you Greg's information. Greg, if you will put your address in as well as your phone number in the same text box. I've got your email address. I've got your name. And so that I can pass that on and give that to Matt. And then you guys can, when I do that, I'll connect the two of you together. And then you can figure out the arrangements there. So congratulations, Greg. Your name is not familiar to me, so I think you might be a new listener. And what a great day for you. So congratulations. And I'm sure you're more than happy about that. Well, Matt, hey, thank you so much for being on the show tonight and sharing your knowledge and experience on the Green River. I know I learned a lot. I'm sure everybody else did. And thanks so much.
Absolutely. Thank you so much for having me. It was a pleasure.
You're welcome. Hopefully you've all found the podcast archive on our website. And if you haven't, just look for the link on the top line of our menu. In that archive, you'll find all of our past shows, over 400 some shows. You can search by keyword, keyword phrase, like trout, tarpon, Madison River, Green River, and so forth. Go ahead, check that out. I'm sure you'll be pleasantly surprised at all the information you're going to receive. Our next broadcast will be on March 5th, 7 p.m. Mountain, 9 p.m. Eastern Time. And on that show, I'll interview Greg DeMars. And the show is going to be on urban fly fishing in the Dallas-Fort Worth area. Greg DeMars has fished all over the world, but the waters around Dallas-Fort Worth area are his home waters. Greg will guide us to the hidden gems and unexpected fishing spots in the heart of the bustling Metroplex. And whether you're a seasoned angler or a curious novice, join us to uncover secret creeks teeming with fish, all set against an urban backdrop of DFW. Don't miss out on this adventure that's just around the corner. You can add this to your calendar, just right underneath Greg's picture on our homepage. You can add the show to your calendar, and then you won't miss that. So check that out, and we'll see you then. We'd like to thank Fly Fishers International, Trout Unlimited, Bonefish and Tarpon Trust, Olympic Peninsula Skagit Tactics, the Ugly Bug Fly Shop, and Watermaster for sponsoring our show tonight. Don't forget to visit our website at askaboutflyfishing.com and make sure you're signed up to receive our announcements so you don't miss out on any of our future broadcasts. Thanks for listening to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio. We hope you enjoyed the show. That's it. Good night, everyone, and good fishing.